filed, I mean, the LA Confidential began literally with The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, because the success of that movie is what got me the ability to make this picture and make it in the way that I wanted to make it. And I had a great experience with Jeffrey, contrary to publicized experiences that other people had at that time. Yeah, I mean, he drove me crazy for a while, but in the second week of shooting, I got a call. I was in the house with these two women that couldn't stand one another, and the baby was crying, and I got this call that Jeffrey Katzenberg was on the phone, and I went outside, and he took the call, and I was thinking, you know, what the hell is this going to be now? And he said, I want you to know I'm not going to look at dailies anymore. You're doing a great job. See you when you get back. Bang. End of story. Yeah. And it just couldn't have been a happier.
It's interesting how film could reverberate down the line. You know, the axiom about you're only as good as your last picture. Here you're saying that a movie farther removed in time.
Well, The River Wild built upon it. Yeah. You know, the fact that I did this action adventure movie with Meryl Streep that was logistically very difficult and that was commercially successful. Those two movies got me to the position where I could, you know, those, they were jobs for hire. And, you know, it's a business, and as a director for hire, you get what you can get and you do the best you can with them. Being lucky enough to have the success of those two movies, I had clout, as they say, sufficient to be able to go in and say, this book that I just read is the movie I want to make, and have somebody say, okay, at least initially okay. It then became clear Warner Brothers owned the book, and they'd had it for a few years with nothing happening. It then became clear that the way in which I wanted to make it, that it was kind of a hybrid, more independent than studio movie. Enter Arnon Milchan's company, who actually financed the picture.
Some of his paintings probably were on the wall.
And it literally, again, you know, Arnon, it wasn't because I was a nice guy or something. It was because I had a certain credibility from the success of those movies that Arnon said, okay, and allowed me to cast the movie in the unorthodox way that I did, which to whatever degree the movie works is fundamentally valid, vital to that success, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Could we talk about Rollo Tomasi? No.
Okay.
This has got to be a not-so-subtle allusion to The Usual Suspects, maybe?
Not at all.
This is not Kaiser Soze?
No, not at all. It is what it is. It's a character thing of one character explaining what he's all about. You know, it's extremely personal. It's the time that this guy, who's been very guarded and repressed and so forth, lets down his guard and explains what he's about, which has a reaction from the other character that Kevin just does. I mean, I saw the movie again last night, and his reaction when Ed says to him, why did you become a cop? And that there's that long pause before he says, I don't remember, is just, I mean, it floors me every time I see Kevin do that. But that's what it's for. And then, of course, it becomes something that Kevin, in a sense, can use to, you know, I don't want to give away what happens in the movie, but it can, the irony of it, the meaninglessness of it, the meaningfulness of it, all of that is on his face when he says it. And then, of course, it ends up being a way that, you know, he's gone, but he's collaborating with these other two guys. He's very much still present, even when he's gone.
I mean, it is what haunts Law and Order, the man who got away.
Yeah.
Whoever.
Exactly.
He was.
Exactly. Now, if you mean the choice of the words themselves, that was actually, I mean, there's, Brian, my screenwriting partner, came up with that name, and I liked it because it's memorable. You know, and obviously, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that everybody has to kind of keep track of, and you don't want people going, "What's who's that guy?" You know, you want to be able to remember that. Oh, that's what he said. And I, in fact, suggested changing it to a name that was a little less memorable. And in rehearsal, and Kevin and Brian jumped on me, and I thought, all right, the hell with it. No, it was a name that came from his childhood, actually. It was kind of a makeup childhood name. And, you know, and as I say, I liked it when I heard it, and we went with it, and I questioned it.
Well, when I alluded to Usual Suspects, it was entirely complimentary because it's a mythic resonance.
Oh, I didn't take it. No, I didn't take it negatively. Yeah. I was just trying to be. There are allusions to movies in this movie,
yeah.
But that's not one of them. You know, The Bad and the Beautiful, for instance, is a very deliberate allusion on
very
my part.
Apt.
Well, apt in ways. I'm happy you feel it. It's apt in other ways. I mean, it's apt in a way specific to this collaboration that I had, because first of all, I didn't use movies to show my collaborators what I was wanting to do. I used still photos. I'd put together 15 still photos that represented the theme of the movie, the look of the movie, the characters of the movie, and so forth. And I used these pictures, starting with Arnon, with whom I met before he read the script, and I went through these pictures. The first one of which you saw, it's the first shot in the movie, the postcard of Los Angeles with the little images of the Garden State, Golden State. And these shots all illustrate, they start with the image of LA, and then they go into, there was a particularly salacious cover of Confidential magazine. I say, okay, now we peel back the image and go to where our characters live. And there were some Ouija-like crime photos. And then there were some photos of a couple of jazz musicians, and I said, this is what the picture's going to look like, because these guys look like they're in Gap ads. You know, they look contemporary. And, one of them, Chet Baker, was in a Gap ad. and this is also what the movie's going to sound like. And then I had some movie star glamour shots, one of Veronica Lake, obviously, and I said, this is what they sell to the suckers. It's the previous era. And then I had some contemporary shots from fashion magazines of women dressed in 50s-inspired clothes. And the point being, and Kevin Spacey's clothes, for instance, a publicity shot of a couple of actors of the time. And I said, the point being, the audience will sit there not going, look how quaint they used to dress, but instead going, I'd like to be wearing those clothes, or I'd like my girlfriend to be wearing them, or she'd be saying, I want to wear those clothes. So those photos combined with, I happened to see an exhibit of a photographer named Robert Frank at the time I was writing the script. There was an exhibit in New York called The Americans that knocked me out. And it knocked me out because you had these period photos, but they were contemporary in their feeling. And I mentioned that to Dante Spinotti, my cameraman, and Robert Frank very much became our kind of touchstone between us to try and capture that feeling of, on the one hand, casualness in the way the setups were, that they didn't sort of draw attention to themselves, and to be accurate to the period but keep it in the background and keep the characters in the foreground and the emotion. I mean, the one thing I wanted to avoid at all costs, was telling the story through the lens of nostalgia, or doing something that would be perceived as an homage to The Big Sleep, let us say, which is a masterpiece, you know, as is Chinatown, but I didn't want to be appearing to ape those movies, so hence these stills. Now, it's a long-winded way to get to The Bad and the Beautiful, but as everybody came on board, I also had a little mini film series, because I wanted people like Mally Finn, my casting director, to see the faces and the body types and all. The first picture I showed was The Bad and the Beautiful. Why? Because that picture, more than any other, sums up to me the romance of Hollywood and in fact perpetuates the romance of Hollywood. And I showed it to say, this is what we're not doing. Even though I love this movie, we're avoiding this except in the specific instance with Kim Basinger's character, where she's selling that to the suckers, so that her house and her, the furnishings inside the house and all should harken back to the decade prior and be a stage setting. But what we're doing is apart from that, so that when you go into the back room where she actually lives, it has a different feeling. And you know, her character sums up sort of the theme to me of the movie, which is the difference between illusion and reality, how things appear and how they really are. And she's selling that illusion, but she obviously is something different, you know. And I was able, I mean, Elroy's great, well, in fact, it's on the cover of the screenplay. Her character gave me the opportunity as director to sort of sum it up in one shot, which is to show Veronica Lake on the screen and then literally have Kim step in front of her, and the audience, on one hand, on a plot level, they go, oh yeah, she does look like Veronica Lake. But thematically, what we're saying is, that's that. Here in the foreground is our character, and we're gonna now get into the person that exists behind that illusion.
Maybe as that question was asked, was Elroy ever considered for writing the screenplay?
No.
Why not?
Because what happened was, it's funny, I've never been asked that question before. I like it.
I mean, he's here promoting it, so he's licensed. So.
Yeah, well, what happened was this. I read the book for fun, sure, because I'd read a number of his books, not thinking about a movie. Mm-hmm. This particular one, I got hooked on the characters. It's extremely unsuitable for a movie in many ways. You know, it is, I don't, if you've read it, it's extremely dense, convoluted in its plots and backstories, and as he himself said, of all the books he wrote, the least likely to be adapted into a movie. I just kept thinking about the characters and thinking about the complicated emotional reaction that I had to them, starting with the fact that each one of them, when I met them, I didn't like them. And then as I kept going, I thought, well, maybe I'll like the next one. Maybe I'll like the next one. And those three guys, I didn't like any of them. And his structure in there is very rigid. A chapter for Bud, a chapter for Ed, a chapter for Jack. And yet as I kept going, I got hooked. And I found myself caring about them. And I went, you know, this is like life. You meet people, you make snap judgments, and then you, based on superficial things often, and then you keep going and you find out what's behind the image. It's a theme that's always appealed to me, and for instance, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, thematically, you have this idyllic appearing family, but it's never been tested. The River Wild, you got Kevin Bacon, this guy who appears to be a very viable alternative to Meryl Streep's husband. Most clearly in Bad Influence, where Rob Lowe, this charming, seductive guy, is whether you want to call him temptation or evil or whatever. And I thought, now I can deal with that theme in a much more fulsome way in the city from which I come, which is the city of manufactured illusion. But it was going to be a massive undertaking to try and get a script out of there, and I was going to have to take great liberties with the plot. So my first thought was, rather than thinking of having him do it, I didn't know him, and my first thought was, I'll buy the option on the book and figure it out myself. It turned out Warner Brothers owned it. So I went to them. They'd had it for a few years, and I went to them and said, look, I'd like to make a movie out of this, and made a deal with them. Brian Helgeland, my eventual screenwriting partner, had been trying to get a meeting with them, had a meeting finally set up, and they canceled it. They said they'd just made a deal with me to write and direct it. So Brian then went around and met with me. Mm-hmm. We teamed up. Again, I stayed away from Elroy, because he had done his work, mm-hmm, and it was our inspiration. And I didn't want to be influenced by his possessiveness, defensiveness, opinions, or anything else. Brian and I worked for about a year, off and on, got the script to where I was happy enough to commit to it with the studio. We sent it to Elroy. I called up Elroy. His first words, in so many words to me, were, "My book, your movie. Good luck." I found that to be not only likable, but also I respected it, because I think it's the only sane attitude for a serious novelist to have, because Elroy does not write blueprints for movies. His books are books. And I said, well, despite how you feel, I'd like you to read the script. And we sent it to him. He liked it. He happened to be coming to LA, spending some time there, doing the investigation into his mother's death that produced his subsequent book. So he came to the set a few times. And then after finishing shooting, I invited him by the editing room one day on his way to the airport, and he showed him about 10 minutes of cut footage in which he saw Dudley for the first time, which you should ask him about when you talk to him. Because Dudley Smith, James Cromwell, is so physically different in every way than the Dudley Smith of Elroy's books, who's not only in this book, but in three others. And then I invited him to see a not finished cut, but almost finished cut of the movie at a test screening. And nothing could please me more, or Brian Helgeland, that, as you say, he's here promoting the movie. I mean, he loved it. He was blown away. He and his wife stayed up all night that night talking about it. And I think what he loves about it is that even though it's different in certain ways, it's so clear that his work was the inspiration for it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I come at writing. You know, I have such respect for the storyteller who came first. I mean, if Elroy hadn't been there first, I wouldn't be there.
Well, but it's true to the nature of the book, unlike
that's what I mean.
Another Warner Brothers film, Bonfire of the Vanities.
It's true to the essence of the book.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I adapted Farley Mowat's book, Never Cry Wolf. I adapted Romain Gary's novella, White Dog. White Dog. And
I always wanted to see that. That never got released. That book was incredible.
Yeah. I love storytellers, you know, and my favorite movie makers are terrific storytellers. So I have nothing but respect for the guy who creates the story, and that's why I say I mean, it would be okay if Elroy hated the thing, because I had to do what I had to do, but I'm so thrilled that he likes it as much.
You did The Arousers, which is a wonderful sleeper movie. They have one. I have it on beta.
No.
Tab Hunter. Yeah. I haven't seen it in the movies. That's so
wonderful. Now, that's, again, illusion versus reality. Tab Hunter, this great-looking golden boy of California.
Well, he was in Hollywood Confidential.
I know. Well, in fact, in casting the young actor that Kevin Spacey sets up, I was thinking this guy should be sort of a young Tab Hunter.
He looked like James Dean, though. I thought that kid was supposed to be James Dean.
Coincidentally,
he
has
his shirt open and all.
Well, dressed like him, yeah. In fact, back to those original 15 photos, one of them actually was an early publicity shot of James Dean.
There you are.
And coincidentally, Simon is Australian as well.
Is that right?
Of course, it was Jackson Pollock that really formulated that image of the cigarettes and the T-shirt and all that. Talk about manufacturing the reality, though, of a Hollywood, or of a Los Angeles of 40 some years ago. Some of the difficulties in shooting, what you had to do to dress exterior sets and to keep the illusion intact.
Well, and to appear not to be doing
yeah.
it. You know, mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm most proud of is that, in fact, the movie was all shot. As I put a title at the end of the movie, it says filmed on location in Los Angeles, California, because it's all real. There's only two computer-enhanced shots in the entire movie, whereas when we started out, they were saying, you're going to have to do a lot of CGI, which is very expensive, and put that in the budget. But Dante and I and Janine were just determined not to do that, because we wanted it to feel real. And there are 45 locations in the picture. They're all real. The only time we're on a set is at on the set of Badge of Honor, you know, when they're having the,
yeah.
And even for that, we're on a period soundstage. And we built the Victory Motel, but it's in Baldwin Hills in the oil fields, and so it's on location. And it was the one thing that just doesn't exist anymore. We went all the way to Bakersfield to try and find a sort of motor court of the appropriate period that also would be in an interesting kind of semi-remote area. It was a huge challenge and a great opportunity because LA is the city I grew up in. I have all these images from childhood of it, and to try and sort of capture that, I had a great team.
Did you find any examples of LA itself trying to recreate a 50s look in its architecture and drive-ins?
Well, LA, it's interesting because LA has no respect for its own past. You know, it's famous for it, with things just being torn down and left, right, and center. But in fact, the city's still there. You know, as you go around to different areas, you can see what you want to see. It's a little bit like looking at a movie that you know very well and love on late night television when it's been butchered with commercials and edited out into oblivion. But you can still, if you kind of put on the blinders and weed out all the crap, you can still recognize that movie and even get an emotional response. Well, LA is that way. And an interesting thing happened. You know, one of the themes, I mean, the reason I wanted to make this movie in LA at this time is that the kind of dream of LA, this sort of garden spot in the sun, was literally being bulldozed into oblivion to make way for all the people that were coming out there in pursuit of that dream. I mean, the freeways, which probably seemed like a good idea at the time, destroyed much of what was unique in Los Angeles. And during the long time that we were making this movie, as we were in these little neighborhoods surrounding downtown, it struck everybody we all got kind of into the feeling of Los Angeles of that time and how small it was. I mean, that room where those cops are, we paid great attention to trying to replicate the detective bureau that was in City Hall at that time, and it was small. You know, that station where the cops riot, which by the way is based on fact, that Bloody Christmas incident, that's the Hollywood station. You know, we shot it in the Venice station, which was built one year later, and it's exactly the same because the Hollywood station doesn't exist anymore. But that station was it for Hollywood. I mean, it's like small town. And you could get from Mrs. Lefford's house, which is in a semi kind of garden-y canyon place just out of Echo Park, you could get downtown in less than 10 minutes, just down Sunset. It's still there. It's just different. You know, I happen to like LA, and so I don't mind that it's different. And it neighborhoods that I knew as a kid as one thing are now, it's like you're in not only another country, but another continent.
You know, what part of LA did you grow up in?
As a kid, I lived semi-downtown in what was known as the Wiltern neighborhood, Wilshire and Western. Coincidentally, Elroy lived in that same neighborhood part of his childhood. Then my father was a school teacher and taught and got a job out in a town called Reseda in the San Fernando Valley, and then Tarzana.
Pretty bad now too.
And then Tarzana. It's not bad. It's just, you know. I don't call them bad. I mean, the fact
that
neighborhoods.
Gangs is bad.
Gangs.
Gangs
are bad.
Being a gang area.
Well, there are gangs in Reseda. Yes, there are gangs there, but it's still, you know, there's a lot more. It's just like there's a lot more to LA than the movie business. You know, it's kind of you hang a label on things. But and then I've lived in Hollywood and lived down in the Venice area.
Do you have mixed feelings about this film now opening in this renewed debate about tabloid journalism? Do you think it'll somehow make people perceive the film a little differently than they might have read it?
I think if it does, it will in fact help, because again, why Los Angeles? Why 1953? I don't mean help commercially, but I mean help illuminate the theme of the movie. there was a lot of stuff starting in LA in that period of post-war boom and expansion and optimism that are still very much with us today. The freeways, television, tabloid journalism. And when it started, it was a reaction to the fan magazines that were studio controlled, that were complete phony image-making publicity machines. And the first magazines, Confidential, Hush Hush, etc., what they were doing is peeling that back and saying, that's phony. You know, behind that, here's Robert Mitchum and, you know, smoking pot. Here's so-and-so doing this, that, and the other thing. The fact that it then grew into a whole industry and that there is this seeming obsession both with celebrities and with that kind of journalism, it's just like the LAPD. I mean, in other words, the freeways, which seemed like a good idea at the time, as I say, destroyed much of what was good in Southern California and much of what was good in a lot of cities. The LAPD, which was very consciously being remodeled at that time from a typical force with typical old-style corruption, cops on the take, into a organization modeled on the Marines from World War II, well, that created a clean force, but a force that has other problems, needless to say, that are mirrored in what's happening in New York right now. You know, where when cops become sort of empowered and there's a feeling that they can do no wrong, it creates a whole different thing. And that, again, is what I liked in Elroy's book, the fact that he's saying, look, television was used through Dragnet to sort of sell this image to not only the people in Los Angeles, but all over the country, that this is the model of a modern police force. And that's why I like that line at the end where the chief says to the people, next year, the LAPD will move into its new facility, and LA will finally have the police force it deserves. Well, that's like Danny's earlier at the beginning of the script saying, radio, television, once you whet the public's appetite for the truth, the sky's the limit. Well, they're both right. You know, it's prophetic.
Okay, we've got to move on. Thanks
okay.
very much.